This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is pre-recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
Welcome back to the Michigan Insider here on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. It's now time for the MGoBlog Roundtable. Brian Cook is here. Craig Ross is here. Seth Fisher is here. Sam is on the field at Ferris State for what was the Sound Mind, Sound Body Camp, the best of the Midwest. I don't know, whatever they want to call it today. Some big camp, the biggest camp maybe in the country during this weeks of kids working out in front of college coaches and being coached up by the college coaches. So Sam will be back on the air tomorrow, recap that camp. But in the meantime, fellas, welcome back into the round table. Happy June. How are you guys?
Great.
Good.
It happened to Detroit Day.
Yeah, I know Seth's great because yesterday was Detroit Day. We're going to get into basketball in a moment and jump into the conversation Sam and Tim are having about Hunter Dickinson. But first, Seth, you have all your Detroit gear out on display for those that are watching on Ticket TV. You got Detroit on your shirt.
We got the Vipers here. Look at that. The Detroit Vipers inaugural season. Oh, yeah. I am excited about Detroit Day. And I don't know how many people actually were from Detroit who were on campus yesterday for Detroit Day. But if they need somebody to come in and, like, you know, give a speech about how Lou Whitaker belongs in the Hall of Fame, I'm here.
And you see Brian's reaction there. I don't think that's what Detroit Day was all about, Seth. It was a great day on campus. Sam Maria talked a lot about it on the recruiting roundup this morning. I know you were very much in celebratory mood. And before we jump into the basketball conversation, just the concept of having a day where you bring in kids from the state and you're highlighting the state. I'll start with you, Brian. It seems like this is kind of the part of the idea of what they did of reshaping the recruiting department, bringing in some of these different assistant coaches on the staff to have a bigger focus on the state of Michigan. So might as well have events like a Detroit Day that it sounds like they're going to try to continue into the future.
Yeah, I mean, these kind of things have been going on for years now, and they're all the same. They just have different names. Like, there's the barbecue at the Big House with Rodriguez and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you theme your days and market yourself and hope to get some recruits.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good idea to pay some attention to the state of Michigan and to obsess some about recruiting in the state of Michigan. I mean, we are actually located here, and there's good information that teams that recruit close to home within, say, a couple hundred miles tend to do better, other things being equal. So, yeah, I think it's good to do that. I mean, well, I'll let Seth speak to this for a moment, but I have a sort of ancillary issue about what's going on in the Michigan football coaching staff related to this. But what do you think, Seth?
Well, I think that under Don Brown, that they were going after a lot of guys in Massachusetts, and a lot of the Detroit coaches kind of took notice and said, look, you know, I understand if you're going after five stars, but if you're going to take someone else's three stars all the time, why don't you take them from us, right? We've got guys too. And I think that the coaches probably overstated the issue, and I think that Michigan actually did a good job in Massachusetts recruiting, but it created issues that was creating issues for them in some of their in-state recruitments that they do need to win. And I mean, it's goofy, right? It's as goofy as me putting up my banners and my jerseys, but I mean, that's recruiting is goofy, and I love it. I love that they're focusing on Detroit, not just for the recruiting aspect, but because that's kind of a, I don't know, this is where I live, and it's really annoying that the local radio station is full of Sparties, and that, you know, my kid I grew up down the street from, Matt Ishbia, is like putting his Spartan labels on everything. Like, I think today they announced United
with the Pistons, yeah.
Yeah, he's going to put his tag on the Pistons, which fine. Matt, you do whatever you want to. I remember when you were a huge Michigan fan. But, it's cool to get some Michigan up back in Detroit because that's the history here. And I was doing that, like that all Detroit team, right, and looked at all these great players we had, and I left out Kramer for some dumb reason, but the amount of stars that Michigan's had even recently from Detroit, you can build a team entirely of All-Americans just from Detroit. And I think you can do that at like Miami. You could probably do that with USC and LA. But there's not a whole lot of other places that have a city that could provide an All-American team just out of your alumni. So I think it's cool, and I love Detroit, so I'm here for it.
A couple of side thoughts on that. One is that if you get a kid from the area, it's more likely they have psychic ties to the program than, say, somebody from someplace else. Not always, but if you grew up a Michigan fan, if you grew up in the state of Michigan, you know, your sort of emotional connection to the program may be more profound, and that may lead to that person being more bought in to what the program is trying to do. A second thing is you can actually pay attention to them while they're in high school more easily if they're in Detroit versus what's going on down in Miami. It doesn't mean you can't get tape, but it's just easier to keep an eye on that kid, what he's doing in school, what he's doing on the field, you know. So I think there's a lot to be said for locally recruiting, other things being equal. Connected to that, I wonder what you guys think about what Michigan's doing on the extensions in the football staff. I mean, they extended Gattis, I think, in the last week for another year. They extended all of the assistant coaches, it looks like, have at least 2 or 3 years on their contract. I mean, on one hand, maybe this is a recruiting thing. On the other hand, it sort of says to me, hell or high water, it's Jim Harbaugh here. And because you can't bring in an outside coach into a staff that you didn't pick, or at least I think that would be ordinary thinking on point. I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on that, or is it, I mean,
you can't recruit on a 1-year deal. So
right.
They had to do something, and yeah. I haven't looked at Gattis's contract specifics, but I know Harbaugh's is not the hardest to get out of. And
correct.
I imagine that, like, if we're in a case where Michigan has to fire Harbaugh and they need to get rid of some of their assistants in order to get the guy that they want, I don't foresee Michigan having that issue. I mean, that's going to be small potatoes next to the issue of, you know, let's get a head coach and pay him and pay whatever we owe Harbaugh. So,
well, and these buyouts are mitigated by whatever new job you get, right? And these guys,
yes,
sometimes you have head coaches who take years off and get that full buyout. And Charlie Weiss is probably still getting paid by Notre Dame. But when you're an assistant, like, that's not going to happen, right? Because you haven't reached the peak of your profession. You're going to want a job somewhere so you can keep climbing the ladder. So anybody who gets bought out after this year is going to have a job somewhere else that's probably going to pay them fairly close to what they got paid here. So the actual outlay from these buyouts isn't going to be super high.
I disagree on that just because I know that the programs underpay those guys when they know that they got a buyout.
Yeah, but they underpay them by like paying them like $250,000, right? So mm-hmm. there's the relative amount of money you'd be paying out on these buyouts is chump change. So
yeah, I mean, there's some
in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, there's some legitimacy to that because, of course, when your contract is broached or breached, you do have the obligation to mitigate your damages. And so if you're a young coach and just say, I ain't going to coach this year, that's probably not good enough. You probably have to actually pursue another coaching job, or you're, you know, in good faith or in some sense of reasonableness. So, yeah, that, you know, you're correct about that, Brian. So the losses may not be quite as big as it seems. On the other hand, you know, Seth's right, too. If someone thinks they can get, you know, Josh Gattis for $200,000 as opposed to his market value, well, they may do that, knowing Michigan's got to ante up the other $700,000 or $800,000. And I don't know how much, you know, somehow fans on internet boards, they always use the word money cannon. And I'm not sure, how realistic that construct is, especially after missing, you know, a year of sports with COVID. How many programs have actual money cannons to fire at people? But
I mean, there's how much money you have on, you know, on hand any given year, which is mostly based off your budget, and then there's how much money you would need to do a big coaching move, in which case you're going to Stephen Ross, and that's, you know, how you do that.
Yeah, what did Columbia to do for the basketball program? They fired the money cannon at the basketball program, didn't they? We assume it's Mark Cuban that underwrote it because someone came in and gave him a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that Michigan needs to have it both ways and can have it both ways. You can't recruit unless these guys have some coach stability, and you can't run your program locked into Harbaugh given the last 6 years have not gone the way we want to. So, you know, what are you going to do? You have to kind of at least do something to show that you're behind your current coach, and that costs money. So that's the that's kind of where they're at. I think they do, and I think this was a great move when they got their staff, like guys like Courtney Morgan, Ron Bellamy, Mike Hart. It doesn't matter Clint who Scale. They hire. Yeah, Clint Scale. Those guys are probably going to survive no matter who you bring in. And there's no one who comes in who says, God, I want to get rid of Ronnie Bellamy, you know?
All right, guys. We all know that for those that are counting, 93 days into the start of the Michigan football season, we did the countdown a little early this morning. When are we going to get our hands on Hail to the Victor, Seth, Brian?
We're still writing it.
What is the status of
it? We're still writing it.
Fans like to know. They like to know when they're reading materials for the.
I'm on the Michigan State preview right now, and I got past the first paragraph, which took me way longer than it needed to get to one paragraph of, well, Michigan State got done what they needed to last year, but so we're working on it. There's a lot changing. Roster's still kind of in flux, and you know, we didn't learn that much from spring, so it's a little bit of a weird year for us.
Yeah, anything from spring?
No.
I look forward to the publication coming out because usually it's the sign of my last, if like we're taking like one last vacation. You know, in this case, we're going to be going away for my parents' 50th anniversary at the beginning of August. And usually I take Hail to the Victors with me, read up on all the stuff that I haven't read up on yet. Usually some great other articles that are not about the current team you've been talking about. Behe's in there, and I'm assuming Craig's in there writing about, you know,
what did we write about, Seth? We wrote about
1895,
which was really interesting for those, you know, interested. I found 1895 a very interesting year of football. So.
Well, we look forward to reading that later on this summer, Craig.
Yeah, Adam Schnepp also talked to all the guys who participated in the Sugar Bowl. And I think he's still got another interview coming up. So that's a really fun article. I just got done editing that one. And I did a whole thing on the Ravens, Ira, that you're going to love.
Awesome. Appreciate that. And that's not for one person, because it does relate, obviously, over to the Michigan side. All right, guys, let's jump over to basketball. We'll go back to the conversation that Sam and Tim McCormick are having in the second half of the 8 o'clock hour. It was focused completely on Hunter Dickinson, his decision to test the waters, or whatever you want to call the go through the process, the draft process. What are your guys' thoughts on it? Do you guys expect him to come back? Craig, I'm going to start with you. Do you think he's going to come back? What are your thoughts on Hunter's decision?
Well, my original thought is this. This makes no sense for Hunter Dickinson. I mean, it makes sense. What he's doing makes sense. But it doesn't make a lot of sense for him to leave right now. That was my first thought, because, A, it seems like he'll go in the draft, would be my surmise. But he'd probably go in the second round. If he waits a year and he shows he has any kind of exterior game, and he improves his right hand, which wasn't very good this last year. If he does those two things, you know, he's a first round pick, and maybe even in the top, you know, 15, 20 guys in the draft. And now you got to go, in my opinion, if you're someplace in that spot. That was my first thought. My second thought was, well, wait a minute, he's older, right? He's not a young freshman. He's an old freshman, and the NBA is obsessed on ages. Might someone in the NBA look at Hunter Dickinson and say, you know, this guy is showed to be a better defender than we thought he would be coming out of high school last year. His defense wasn't all that bad, and it improved. And if we can get him in a little bit of better shape, and his mechanics on his shot are pretty good, and we see that he's already working on his right hand, because I know he is, maybe they see someone there with a sufficiently high ceiling so that someone between 20 and 30 in the draft says, you know, there's nobody there who I like better or who has a higher ceiling. So it doesn't strike me as impossible that he might go. I know Tim thinks he won't, or thinks it's unlikely. I think it's it's iffier than that. Even though my first reaction was, he's staying. My second reaction is, I'm not so sure. So what do you guys think?
I mean, it'll really depend on what Dickinson himself wants. So I just looked this up. Sam Vecenie's most recent big board, which is the top 100 prospects, mm-hmm. he's got Dickinson in at 56. So, you know, I think that if he's really interested in the NBA like Iggy Brazdeikis was, then that's a viable path to go. From what I think we've heard, this feels more like, Isaiah Livers putting his name in as a junior or Franz last year, right? So just situations where you know that there are things that you need to improve on if you're really going to be an NBA player. And, you know, there are probably fewer places than usual for a guy like Dickinson to improve than there would be for another post anywhere else, right? Because he's going to be coached by Juwan Howard. So, you know, I know the G League is an option for a lot of guys to go through and then come up into the league. And that's, if that's what he wants, that's what he wants. But I kind of feel like, you know, the idea of going to the NCAA tournament, maybe going to a Final Four, playing on this team that looks like it's pretty stacked, and being like the number one guy on that team, those are pretty powerful, powerful reasons to come back. And I think that that's the most likely outcome, because, you know, he's 20 right now. He'll be 21 next year. They're usually a little bit more relaxed about the ages of posts, because posts end up developing late. Well, and he does have upside. If he can develop a shot, if he can, you know, get a little bit more lateral mobility so that he looks more like an NBA defender, then I think he could move up a significant amount.
Yeah, there's nothing to lose for him. You know, he's not really doing anything other than school right now, right? And he's not like leaving school, but he signs with an agent. He gets the opportunity to go through the process. He has the opportunity to like actually get real feedback from the NBA teams and see who's interested in him. And also, like, you know, his style of center is not getting any more popular in the NBA. And that's the only consideration, is that, like, you know, how much longer are they even going to take Hunter Dickinson's? I mean, there's going to be a spot for, you know, a guy off the bench like that. But there's the NBA is just not going that direction, right? It's, you know, it's a...
I think the NBA has already moved as much as it's going to move in terms of, like, what does a center look like?
Right, right.
So I don't think that there's going to be much of a difference in what the NBA wants next year and what Hunter Dickinson might be able to do over the course of a year is demonstrate that he's closer to that than he currently seems.
Sure. So I just don't think there's anything for him to lose. And I think that, you know, why not, you know, try take a shot and see maybe someone, the only thing I'd be really afraid of is if someone actually does look at him and go, wow, this guy does have a stroke and we can develop him. And I want to take this guy and put him in the G League for a year and develop his right hook instead of having him do it in college. But that's the only concern, really.
I mean, you do have Robin Lopez in the NBA, and I think his brother may still be lurking around. I mean, there are some guys in the NBA who are sort of throwbackish kinds of guys. I don't know. I'm a little more, at first I wasn't nervous about this at all. I'm a little more nervous now. Tim said this morning, I think on his interview, that that Michigan fans shouldn't be concerned because there are plenty of guys who are centers who are, you know, in the draft who are going to fall out. And there may be people in the portal for Michigan to grab should Dickinson decide that he really does want to be drafted. I think a guy named Bassey is one guy he mentioned who thinks will probably not be drafted and probably drop out, who he feels would be a good center for Michigan. But I don't know about that. as a fan, I sure as heck want to see Hunter Dickinson next year. And I sure want to be rooting for a team with him on it. And I sure am interested in how Juwan manages to interface Hunter Dickinson and Musa Diabate, whose name I can never pronounce. But the and I'm very curious as to how those two guys fit together. So, yeah, as a fan, I really want to see him back. But, it isn't clear to me at this point that somebody won't say, he's better than anybody we can find at 25 right now. There's enough there of an upside that we really just can't let it go. So I'm feeling this isn't such an easy issue. So,
I feel some of my uneasiness is purely on the unusual nature of the calendar of this, because this is a month later than it normally is.
Yeah.
In July as opposed to June. Mm-hmm. And I'm not used to having this conversation now. This conversation, these are over by now. And I think there's a mental side of it. But I'm kind of with Tim that I mean, he's going to look and he's going to get all that information. I think that in the end, he's going to make the decision to come back. There's nothing for sure, obviously, in any scenario. But the seems to me that this is a great opportunity, kind of, Brian, like you said, like Garza did last year, like Franz did last year, like Isaiah Livers did. Like, you go through this to see and get as much information as you can get for the future and move forward. Now, if this conversation was being had like 25 years ago, I would be scared to death that he'd be leaving because he'd be like a top 10 pick. But
put a counter on it, right? So like last year when Livers put his name in, I don't think we were concerned that he was going to go to the draft, but that told us that no matter what, it was, he was done after this year. And I think that does tell us, not for this year, but for next year, Hunter's probably going, because you can only do that once.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'd be interested if you guys have looked in the 2022 class of the big guys, which ones you might like or prefer the most. I know we're after a guy named Klingon. There's Duren, Tarvis Reed, kid named Lively. I wonder if you've looked at any of those guys and have any impressions on them.
Honestly, haven't, because Matt D has been writing only guards or only wings this week, so I know all about the wings because he's all over that. But there's a whole lot of them that Michigan's looking at, and guards as well. But they did need to get some clarity. I know Diabate is probably going to be gone after next year too, so they're going to have to replace their centers. And we'll see what they have at that point.
I have a feeling that they're very aware of how much debt size they're going to need to recruit over these next couple of classes based on what attrition is probably going to look like. So fun to talk some basketball. We'll know about him over the next few weeks because Hunter's going to go through the process and then he has to make a decision by Sam gave this late. Was it early July is the withdrawal date? So we'll find out over the next give or take about a month what Hunter Dickinson's future will be for the upcoming season for the Michigan Wolverines or if he decides to stay in the draft.
Now, speaking to the comments real quick, yes, there is a conspiracy against the Red Wings, Chad.
Yeah, I was reading these. I was waiting to get to let you.
I have a tinfoil hat, a Red Wings, a Wingnut tinfoil hat around somewhere from when I did a thing with all the Red Wings bloggers back in the day, like the Herm to Hockey Town deal. And everybody, like the whole group of Red Wings bloggers and friends, all sat in Joe Louis Arena with Wingnut hats covered in tinfoil.
So what happened with the, with the Wings and the.
They had no luck. Basically, they had no luck.
Yeah,
are they drafting?
They were in the lottery for the first time in 20 years or 30 years or whatever, and they got the lowest pick they could get. So,
last year when they could have gotten one and they got down to like seven or whatever. Yeah. They were in the sixth slot and they're picking six. I think part of the lamenting is, and I don't disagree. Buffalo had the best odds and they get the first pick as opposed to
when the Wings kept on having the best shot
they get totally shit
right there. And the Penguins got the best got the first pick 2 years in a row back when they got Crosby even though there wasn't even a season the year before Crosby and like it seems like the NHL when they need to pick up a franchise has no problem putting a team first overall but I mean whatever this wasn't the year to get the first overall pick anyway.
I was going to say, it seems to me that it isn't even, I mean, it's not like there's one player out there who's a franchise changer this year. I mean, I keep hearing that Owen Power may be the
Owen Power's pretty much. I think someone asked Steve Yzerman yesterday, like, you know, who would you pick at number one? And he goes, well, who would you pick? And the guy's like, Owen Power. And he's like, okay, yeah, that's easy. But who's number two? Right? So, like, Owen Power seems to, this week, have played his way into the number one overall pick, not because he's got the highest ceiling, but because his floor is still great.
Yeah.
And having a great defenseman. Right. And having like a solid, good defenseman. How many years have we gotten to trade deadline during the Red Wings run? And they just needed one solid defenseman like that. So to be able to draft one at first, I could take it. Owen Power is an easy first overall pick, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I'm not sure there's a whole lot difference between Owen Power and whoever the Wings will get at number six. And which will probably be another Michigan guy, because it looks like five of the first eight players are whatever it is are going to be.
I just hope Michigan. They go to teams that actually will let them develop in college.
Yeah, like, that's right.
Like no one's going to take Power and leave him in college, but you know the other guys.
Leave them alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, because Beniers is going to go pretty fast, I assume. Is the Hughes in this draft, the young Hughes in this draft too? I think he might be.
I'm not sure. Brian, is the next Hughes in this draft or is the one after?
He's in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that there's a franchise changing player in this NHL draft. And it looks to me like who the Wings get at six may not be all that much different in terms of quality than Owen Power, as good a player as Owen Power is. It looks like a pretty flat and early part of the draft in terms of abilities.
Are there NHL teams that we're worried about? I remember you used to hating LA.
I want to ask this question. We're coming back on the air, guys, in a second. So, but I want to ask that question on there. Welcome back to the Michigan Insider, second part of the MGoBlog Roundtable here on Sports Talk 1050, WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. I'd say we were having a fun Wings conversation during the break, but talking about all the times that you feel like they're on the short end is not a fun conversation, but it was an interesting conversation, and we're going to bring that conversation back to this segment because it's Michigan-related, because like half of the first round could be Michigan guys in the draft this year. The draft lottery for the NHL was last night. The Wings hold in the sixth spot. But Seth, you were going to ask a question. At least I'm assuming this is the question you're going to ask, which is essentially which organizations should Michigan be fearful of?
Yeah, who's the LA of today?
Versus which organizations do we like because they're college friendly and would tell guys that they draft to stay in school for at least another year? Do you have some sort of a list in your head, Brian?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of teams that are usually fairly Michigan friendly in terms of leaving kids. I think Vegas's GM is a program alum, so that helps. Boston is a team that's always been pretty patient with their guys. I don't know if Michigan hasn't had enough like high-end guys over the past few years to know exactly what's going to happen when they get a bunch of top 10 picks. Now, you know, people were talking like, yeah, all these guys could come back. And it's possible, but, you know, Owen Power returning after going to World Championships and essentially functioning as Canada's number one defenseman for a portion of that tournament.
Yeah.
Not happening. Right? Like, yeah. He's the consensus number one overall pick. I can't remember the last time a number one overall pick didn't sign and just played with and against NHLers in a tournament setting and didn't look out of place. So you can drop him into whoever got the first overall pick.
Buffalo.
Yeah, he'll be in their opening day lineup, I think, which is fine because Michigan loses him and they lose Cam York from their blue line, but they're going to bring in Luke Hughes, who is another potential top five pick. And they are also bringing in Ethan Edwards, who went in the third round last year. So they've got two guys who should be high-level defensemen, not at the level of Power, obviously, but you know, when those are your guys that you're plugging in when you lose a couple guys to the NHL, that's a good situation. And then, you know, Beniers could go top five. Kent Johnson looks like a top 10 prospect. So you're going to have some threats there. I think both those guys are in a spot where, you can tell that they would probably be AHL players next year. And some programs will want to do that, but a lot of them are just content living them in college these days. So I'm hopeful that they're able to get those guys back for their sophomore seasons. And then, like, you know, you're probably going to get Bortolo and Brisson back. You've got Mackie Simoskovic, who's going to be a fringe first rounder. You have Dylan Duke, who's probably labeled for the second round. And I think Dylan Duke is going to be really important for this team because he's the kind of guy who will go in the corners. And they didn't really have that guy last year, especially after Beecher went out. So I think he's a guy who you can slot into an important line and have him play a role, you know, create space for a guy like Kent Johnson if you do get him back. So yeah, it'll be interesting for Michigan because we've seen a lot of attrition, and the word on the street is currently like, yeah, they're going to come back. And I can see that being more likely because they had a season where there was nobody in Yost. And one of the reasons you come to Michigan is to experience a season in Yost. And then they got to the tourney and they got pulled out of it because of a COVID test. So they must feel very unsatisfied. And I would guess that there's a better chance that some of these guys come back than usual.
Yeah, we didn't actually mention that part of it with Hunter too. Just the not going through a normal year of experience. Anyone that was a freshman last year that didn't play in front of fans that wanted a college experience of playing, you know, their college sport, that it's in itself might be enough of a draw to go back to school. For those that are asking, the draft is July 23rd and 24th. So, Craig, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's okay. I mean, yeah, in terms of Hunter, I mean, a year in Chrysler with fans who are behind him and excited about the team may be a little more compelling than having a water bottle thrown at your head. I mean, or whatever else is going on in the ordinary NBA arena these days. In terms of hockey, yeah, I keep hearing from people who pay really close attention to hockey and have some tangential contacts that they expect, except for Owen Power, most of this team be back. I mean, do you think Beecher will be back? I mean, I assume so.
Beecher
was a first-round pick a couple of years ago.
He's a late first-rounder. He is with the Bruins, as mentioned. That's an organization that's pretty patient. He got hurt at the end of last year.
Yeah.
And honestly, he hasn't had the kind of breakout season that would cause someone to sign him right now. So, okay. You know, I think that Boston is probably going to leave him in college and see what happens after this year.
Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be. I guess the theory is to actually have fans next year at the ice arena. And
did we pass the mark? I know we were what 70% of Michiganders had to be vaccinated for them to open up Yost entirely.
The July 1st all restrictions are lifting July 1st. So it sounds like we're going to be at full capacity in the fall for all sports, unless something changes.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, the nice thing is, all of Michigan's programs, the spring programs, the fall programs, all look really solid and in good shape, with one possible exception that I won't mention. And so, you know, it could be a really exciting year for Michigan sports fans because the teams are in good shape.
Yeah,
programs are in good shape.
Before we put a bow on the sports season that's not quite over yet, we did get a question here about Brandon Inge. Will he help Michigan? Can he help Michigan win a baseball, the NCAA tournament? I don't think Brandon Inge's addition is going to be what pushes it over the top. Michigan just has to get hot like they did a couple years ago. It was a great run. I mean, you could say, why can't they do it again? I'd say the answer is because it's really hard, but they've got talent in place. It's just a matter of, can you get hot at the right time? I don't think that the Brandon Inge addition makes one way or the other makes a difference.
Alex Drain and David Nasternak put out an other sports cast this morning, and Drain made a good point that Michigan's actually had more talent than the rest of the Big Ten for a while. It's just they keep getting bitten, and this is a reference to, like, you know, the loss at the end of the season here and Nebraska winning the Big Ten title, this has been a problem across baseball that you run into a hot pitcher and it's over, right? And double elimination is so it's so easy just to lose two games to anyone just, you know, because a pitcher got hot, and sometimes pitchers have good days. So, that's always going to be the trouble. I think that was a little, they punched a little bit above their weight last year to go to the World Series. I wouldn't expect that every year, but I also think they kind of underperformed this season. And, you know, they're going to South Bend and you never know. Notre Dame's had a great season, but they might even not face Notre Dame. They could, you know, Notre Dame could lose two games quickly.
I went back. Go ahead.
Last year they had that 1-2-3 pitching punch, right, with Kaufman and Criswell.
Henry.
Henry. And that was in a tournament environment. If you have three pitchers and you don't really need to get into your bullpen, that is just a huge advantage. And that is not the case this year. So it's going to be much more difficult for them to just ride a smaller portion of their roster.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Michigan has two very good starters, been pretty consistent most of the year, and Hadger. I'll mispronounce it every time. Stephen Hadger and Cam Weston, who've both been really good. And but the problem for Michigan is they don't really have a third starter. I think they wanted Blake Beers to be that starter because he'd had some success in the past and he has good stuff. But the problem is he has had a very difficult time throwing strikes this year. And he's gotten, aside from the base on balls and the hit batters, he's had difficulty getting ahead in the counts. He's been behind in the counts way too often. So Michigan's pretty much riding with two. But the interesting thing is this is a truly fascinating regional when I started to look at the other teams. I mean, Central is good, and they may have the best pitcher in the regional. And this guy, I don't even know his name, is Taylor, I think. He's
the best pitcher of the year.
Yeah, and his numbers are unbelievable. His strikeouts versus base on balls compared to the number of innings, ERA, the whole range of it is off the charts. Now the question is, well, how good is the MAC? The answer is, I don't know. Same as the Big Ten, I don't know. I mean, if you're looking across, if you assume the competition has been equalized, the worst team in that regional, Notre Dame. But it's hard to know, if that's the case. UConn, I think, beat Michigan a couple of times last year in the spring. And they've got two really good pitchers, and one pretty phenomenal. I think they have one hitter hitting .411 on the season, and they've got some offensive ability, but that they've got two good starters at the top there. In fact, they look a lot like Michigan. Two good starters. The questions after that, some problems in the bullpen, a pretty good lineup. The good thing that Michigan's got going for them is they really have a bunch of guys who can hit the ball. They're not often you see college teams with three or four guys, and then you sort of wait till you get to the back top of the lineup again. Michigan really has 9 or 10 hitters. And none of them are superstars, but they're all good, solid hitters. I mean, I think they have a team batting average of about .275, and they probably got 10 guys hitting between .260 and .320 or .330. I think Sims, the shortstop, is the highest. So, Michigan has a good chance to come out of this regional winning, but my guess is so does Central, so does UConn, so does Notre Dame. It really will be fun to watch, in my opinion, and to get some sort of a gauge on, well, what does the rest of the country really look like in baseball, because we just haven't seen much interregional play, especially for the Big Ten. The Big Ten hasn't had any interregional play, I don't think.
It'll be really interesting to see how far Maryland and Nebraska go, because those could be really good teams, or Michigan could have played down to their level, and I really don't know.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows, and it feels somehow wrong that Indiana isn't in this tournament. Indiana has a good team. They're not much different than Nebraska, Michigan, Maryland. Those teams were, I thought, very close in abilities. And, and Indiana has some history of doing well in the recent history of doing reasonably well in the NCAA. So to me, I felt badly for them because it felt like they should be in this tournament. But to some extent, perhaps the Big Ten did it to themselves. And I'm not saying it was unreasonable, but by playing 44 games all in conference. And so the answer is, who knows? On the other hand, you know, Notre Dame's out of conference games were Valparaiso, you know, so I'm not sure what you can get out of playing Valpo. So,
all right, guys, that's the baseball action starts tomorrow. Notre Dame's game is early, I think 1 o'clock tomorrow. Michigan plays tomorrow night. I think it's at 7 o'clock, and we'll hopefully be talking about Michigan's success in baseball coming up next week on the show. We'll watch over the weekend. One more topic of conversation for the roundtable here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com before we wrap up here on this Thursday edition of the show. This conversation has come up because of the Naomi Osaka situation at the French Open, and she withdrew. And Craig probably has a lot of thoughts on this because he's a big tennis guy.
Yeah,
I thought of it more just in the conversation about where we're headed with press conferences, the fans view of a press conference. And you guys come from three pretty different perspectives on this. I'm kind of curious your thoughts on the use of the value of press conferences at this stage, and or the value of getting these big group interactions. I'm not talking about one-on-one interviews that, you know, media still get with athletes, because one-on-ones are different. Just specifically these big group sessions, whether they're on Zoom like they have been during COVID, or when we get back to being in one big room. Brian, you don't go to press conferences. I don't know what your thought process. I know you send people to press conferences, you read them, you watch them, but I'm curious what your thought is, the value of where things are heading, and we'll let you guys, the other guys, chime in too.
Well, you know, the guys who show up and they're like, talk about this part of my article that I need a quote for, that's pretty useless, right? The guy puts the quote in the article. It's always a very anodyne thing, and he says talk about, and you just turn off. So yeah, there's a lot of kind of fluff in there, and you know, Michigan's a little bit different because we've had our guys around for a lot of time, and Nick Baumgartner asked some pretty detailed questions. And when you get a detailed question to a guy like Don Brown about something that happened on the field, he'll answer it. And you know, I think a lot of football coaches do respond to. So the 3rd and 6 where they jump the slants, what was going on there? Like you'll get real answers from that. And, you know, when Adam was going to press conferences, he was getting some like kind of side one-on-one time where he just asked a question about a specific play. And one of the things that he asked about, I still remember, was the goal line stand against Minnesota. And he talked to Glasgow about it. And Glasgow had a great answer about like the stances of the other offensive linemen, how they practice this kind of thing. Like it was really interesting and really useful. And so I think that there's still a role for a press conference to offer good stuff, at least in a football context. But it really depends on the people asking the question.
Well, I agree. I mean, my experience with football and football coaches and players is that if you have a good question that's reasonably specific, they want you to have a good answer most of the time. Now, that's not always true. And I won't get into the exceptions that I've had, but if you have a good question, coaches, you know, want you to know the answer. I mean, I thought for me, as a person who went for a number of years to football pressers, I thought Lloyd was the best, because if you actually asked him a question that he thought showed that you were paying attention and wanted a real answer, he would try and make sure you got it. And even if it wasn't right then, it would be later. And so I always really appreciated that from him in particular, but also other coaches at Michigan. I mean, the offensive coordinator with Rich Rod, Calvin McGee, and the quarterback's coach, whose name I'm blocking on right now, were both really good at that. They would try and get you answers. Tennis is a little different, because I think that's what we're talking about here. I have actually been interviewed coming off a tennis court in the city tournament. And not suggesting I'm a particularly good tennis player. I'm just suggesting I've played a lot of tennis.
Did the question start at 80 years old?
Yeah. And so the questions are always like, well, how did you win that match, or how did you actually happen to be out here and not win a single point? I mean, things like that. And, you know, I end up talking about the wind or what I ate for breakfast. I don't know. I mean, you know, and I find these tennis interviews on court boring and cringeworthy, generally. I mean, they're just not very interesting. They're just not very good. And I almost always just turn them off because I don't want to hear what the person has to say. Now, the post-tennis, post-match interviews are occasionally enlightening. But what really is going on with tennis is they want people, it's a game of personalities. And they want people to see that Roger Federer speaks five languages unaccented and is fluent in all of them. Because that's basically good for tennis. He can answer the question in French, he'll answer it in English, he'll answer it in German and Italian if you need to. And I think that's essentially good for the sport, particularly with Roger Federer, who is, in my opinion, the greatest tennis player who ever lived. And it's the same, you know, in for all the players. They want to see the personality of that player. They want to see what that player's like, because that's what tennis is. People don't come out for tennis except they've got favorites. So if you go to a tennis match, you'll see people wearing Rafa hats or Federer hats or whatever. And so that's what's going on with tennis. They want the interstices of the game to be talked about, because no one really cares about that, I think. But they want to see the personalities and what those people are like. And so that's why Major League Tennis has fines if you don't show up. If you don't show up to talk about it. Now, my brother suggested, well, you could just lower the purse and then say, if you show up at the press conference, we'll give you an extra XYZ dollars. I guess you could do that, but I don't think it would work, because for some of these folks, you know, XYZ dollars is nothing. I mean, Osaka, who is having some issues of unknown sort to me, just got a $50 million contract. I'm not sure from what sporting goods company, but $50 million for a young kid. And it's partly because she's one of the great tennis players in the world, but it's partly because of her personality and the fact that they've seen her talk and they like her, and she can be a good spokesman for their products. And so any event, yeah, in the tennis world, you need to show up and talk. And I understand why the circuit has drawn the line there, but I don't know if there's a contrary view or not among people who follow it.
I've been removed for a long time from press conferences. I used to do them all the time when I worked in the environmental engineering industry. Had a magazine called
Pollution Engineering. Those must have been great, riveting press conferences.
The most boring.
I saved a lot of those.
Oh my
Both
god!
Both teams played hard.
Oh god! Well, they'd be really boring until the environmental group would show up, and then they'd have their very pointed, angry questions where they really weren't asking a question, and then everyone just kind of roll their eyes and wait for the Sierra Club guy to be done.
That happens at football press conferences too.
So yeah, it was like, you know, but imagine like if half the people were the Michigan State beat at a Jim Harbaugh press conference. That was what they were like. But I remember there was one time it got really interesting with a CEO, because somebody just kind of asked him like, oh yeah, like, do you really care about water quality? And he like showed on the map that he had, that he was using to show his the factory that they'd built, and he's like, you see this river? Right where this river goes, that's where I live. I live right there. This water goes right to my backyard. My kids play in that ravine every single day. And then he got in trouble for it. So, like, this was, like, the only good answer anyone's ever given in one of these stupid press conferences. And he got in trouble with the industry for it because it was, like, not on. So we've turned all, and sports has done a terrible job of this. We've turned all of our sports people into like automatons. If you're not perfect, if you're not this like, you know, representative of this massive company, and I'm sure it's worse in tennis because you're not covering an organization, you're covering a person. And basketball maybe is more like tennis because there's only five guys on the court, and football is just you're covering an organization, and you know, even the coach's personalities are kind of sublimated to the team. But like, the whole thing is just this silly dance where, like, we're pretending these are not human beings. And, like, this controversy comes because, well, not every single human being is Roger Federer, right? You know, sometimes a tennis player is just pushing themselves on the mental edge and you know, being asked these inane questions and getting pressed because you don't have good answers, they fall apart. You know, it happened to Roger Maris when he was doing his chase of Babe Ruth. Like, some people are just not built to answer inane questions like automatons, and some people are great at it. And, you know, Brian mentions, like, sometimes you get a good question and there's and you get a good answer, but 99% of these things are just dull, right? It's just somebody's trying to get a quote to put in their article, and the organizations know this. And they've changed how they operate based off of this interplay. And I think it's the problem now because you have a media industry that is largely that needs that access in order to function, right? They don't know how to write articles. They don't know how to, like, draw stats and create some sort of content that's not related to something the coach gives you in a press conference. And what happens when these organizations slip up, right? What happened at you know, who on the Michigan beat? I mean, Michigan beat is probably, like, maybe one of the best at it, but who on the Michigan beat is capable of covering some of the things that happen here, right? Like the Dr. Anderson scandal, the people covering that best, the person who's been all over that is Kim Kozlowski of the Detroit News. It's not anyone on the Michigan beat. It's the education beat, right? So nobody who needs access is capable of covering their team, even if they're good at it, even if they're moral. It's just the incentive structure is all wrong, and the press conference structure is just it's built to generate nothing.
Appreciate the input, guys. I know it'd be an issue to get viewpoints from all three of you, different perspectives, and appreciate that. Great conversation for the last hour. That's been the MGoBlog Roundtable. We're gonna wrap things up today. Sam resumes the conversation tomorrow morning here on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.